This is an IEEE Computer Society podcast. I'm David Alan Greer, and this is In Our Time. Computing has done an awful lot to deal with problems of management. In some cases, it has helped make things better. There are times, however, when things are just out of whack. And this podcast today deals with such problems. It is called Bad Alignment. It wasn't working. Nothing was in alignment. The coffee was cold, the muffins were stale, and the software presentation was a forced march through a PowerPoint landscape that was denuded of life. 3 hours had passed, and no civilization could be seen on the horizon. In the command of the podium was a perky salesperson named Elena, who suggested ideas of great magnitude where no ideas could be seen. The eight of us on the committee sat in stone, cold silence, praying that an all-merciful divine being would send a band of pirates to attack our meeting, seize this woman, and hold her hostage in a distant and unpleasant country. We held no personal grudge against Elena. We could find no fault in her person or character. However, we could see that the poor dear was not succeeding in the task assigned to her. As the representative of her employer, she was supposed to educate our committee and bring our aspirations into harmony with their goals, to show us that this company would meet our needs when we met theirs. Such a task is not easy, as it demands analysis, imagination, and more than a little empathy. Such qualities are not usually associated with pirates, but we were willing to take our chances. An open and unilateral statement of criminal assessment would have been far preferable to the presentation that we were seeing. The problems of communicating the benefits of technology has bedeviled the industrial age from its inception. So often, new technology is conceived in terms of engineering specifications, processor speeds, data formats, power consumption, manufacturing costs. Rarely do potential customers see technology with the same eyes. They'll be interested in new devices only if it somehow makes their lives better, if it moves them towards a goal that they hold for themselves, their family, their company. As I watched that presentation, I could see that Elena had clearly been schooled in the sales cycle of John Henry Patterson, though she probably knew little about the man. Patterson was the president of the National Cash Register Company at the end of the 19th century. He was one of the first thinkers to understand the problems of explaining new technologies to non-technical audiences. His novel technology, the cash register, was a marvel of mechanical engineering and attracted just as much attention as the personal computer of a century later. Yet that clever engineering, the high-precision gears, the multiple linkages, the novel bearing designs, was not sufficient to attract more than a few paying customers. When a customer was first introduced to the new machine, with its engraved case, the polished brass, they would usually react with a very simple question. What is in it for me? Patterson developed a four-step cycle for connecting the technology of cash registers with the goals of his customers and drilled this cycle into his sales staff. The steps were easy to remember. Identify and propose. Demonstrate and close. They were much harder to follow. The very first step of the process required the salespeople to leave their world of technology and listen to their customers and discover their human needs. Did they feel they were in control of their business? Were they earning enough to support their family? Were they spending too much time at their work? After identifying such issues, Patterson's salespeople were to propose ways that cash registers could be used to solve the problem and demonstrate these solutions. Cash registers could reduce employee theft, simplify accounting, track expenditures, which in turn would reduce anxiety, simplify labor, strengthen confidence. The last steps of the process, the closure of the sales, brought the goals of the customer in line with the needs of the National Cash Register Company. That was the most important part of the process, for Patterson at least. ABC, he always told the National Cash Register representatives. Always be closing. The need to close a sale was clearly known to Arlena, but she didn't know how to work the other steps of the Patterson sales cycle. She started her presentation by saying that she wanted to listen to us and identify our needs. But she quickly proved that she was much more interested in identifying herself. In the course of 15 minutes, we learned about her academic credentials, the number of years that she had worked for the company, the types of schools that had brought software from her, and, if memory serves correctly, the name of the Thai dressmaker who had created the suit that she was wearing. In telling her story, she was little different from the other salespeople that had appeared before us. From them, we had been regaled with corporate histories, stories of programmers who had developed their software, brand names of automobiles and watches that were owned by the sales staff, the revenue goals that had been met or exceeded by their regional office. Such stories were impressive at times, but they showed little analysis and even less empathy. Without identifying our needs, Elena and all the other salespeople had little to propose and less to demonstrate. They wandered through the remaining steps of the Patterson like a group of merchants lost on a vast desert. They would track towards one idea at a time before shifting towards another in the hope that they might catch something of our attention. Eventually, they became lost and panicked. The first sign of trouble came when they started repeating the phrase, "It will do whatever you want to do." No matter what we might want, their software will do whatever you want it to do. The real evidence was seen in the acceleration of the PowerPoint slides. At the start of the presentation, they lingered for 35 or maybe even 45 seconds a slide. As the first hour approached, this dwell time had dropped to 15 seconds, 20 at the most. As we approached the third, the slides were flashing on the screen for no more than 5 or 6 seconds at a time. These slides were detailed, technical graphics, nested matrices, semantic networks, predicate calculus, horn clauses. All of these ideas flew past our eyes, accompanied by the plaintive cry, "Whatever you want, whatever you want, whatever you want." If Elena had asked me what I wanted to do, my response would have been unequivocal. I wanted to finish my service on that committee as quickly as possible. While I could see an obvious strategy that would have aligned that goal with Elena's hopes, I had to acknowledge that the result would not have been entirely satisfactory to all concerned. Our committee actually had a more noble goal. It had been assembled for the purpose of improving the university's approach to assessment. Now, in the world of academe, the term assessment is a term for the more prosaic concept of quality control. It has been part of higher education for a little more than a decade, though it's based on ideas that are considerably older. It uses educational analyses that were developed in the 1950s and employs a basic tool of quality control, the Shewhart cycle of continuous improvement that dates to 1931. The Shewhart cycle is a familiar four-step process that shaped large parts of engineering practice. Plan, do, check, analyze, repeat. We like to believe that there is a law and order in the world, Shewhart wrote. We seek causal explanations of phenomena so that we may predict the nature of these same phenomena at any future time. He knew that sometimes natural phenomena could hide its operations, but he also had great faith in the analytic power of the human mind. He liked to return time and again, as his inspiration, to the great poet of the English Enlightenment, who was Alexander Pope. "All nature is but art unknown to thee," wrote Pope. "All chance, direction, which thou canst not see. All discord, harmony, not understood. All partial evil, universal good." Yet, Shewhart did not quite accept the mechanistic view of universal good that was shared by the contemporaries of the 18th century Pope. He looked for universal good and hoped to find misapprehended harmonies, but knew that analytic reason could not always find them. "We're limited in doing what we want to do," he explained, "because understanding every aspect, even of a simple manufacturing task, in its entirety, requires almost infinite knowledge." Therefore, quality control required the good engineer to accept as axiomatic that we cannot do what we want to do and cannot hope to understand why we cannot. Schuart developed his cycle in conjunction with statistical methodology that allowed engineers to search for problems in production and find ways of bringing those problems under control, at least for a short time. This method was well suited for Schuart's employer, the American Telephone and Telegraph Company, AT&T, because this organization was a highly complicated business that followed a simple, well-articulated goal. That goal was universal service. When AT&T began expanding in the early 20th century, its leadership concluded that both its customers and its investors would be best served by a company that offered a standard telephone service across the United States and that was able to dominate every market in which it operated. This goal required a uniformity that was beyond the scope of any accomplishment of any company operating at the time. Yet, management argued that their goals required standardized operating methods, plant facilities and equipment, and also complete harmony and cooperation of operating forces through centralized and common control. The common goal of AT&T simplified the human dynamics of quality control, made it easier for a team of engineers to empathize with the needs of their neighbor. As any team of engineers marched through the steps of plan, do, check, and analyze, they would need to understand how the other units might view their proposal, which in turn required them to imagine how these units approached the goal of universal service. Of course, such a goal didn't eliminate differences within the corporation, as all employees would interpret universal service in light of their own opinion and aspirations. However, it gave a much stronger foundation for resolving disagreements than the goals found at most universities. In words that have often been expanded and embellished, a university president once described the modern institution of higher education as a collection of rival, warring, tribal factions that are united by a common heating system. Lacking a common heating system, our university is actually united by complaints about the parking garage. As most of the members of the assessment committee took public transportation, we were barely united at all. In spite of our discontents, some of our committee members were comfortable with the academic ideas of quality control, and even with the presentations by the software sales team. In particular, the engineers saw how they might employ these pieces of software, as they had the longest history with educational assessment. Engineering faculty began developing the concepts of educational quality control roughly at the same time that Schuart developed his methods for AT&T. In 1929, the Carnegie Foundation for Teaching established a committee to investigate the state of engineering education. To chair their committee, they recruited William Wickenden, who had been a senior manager at AT&T and was then president of the Case School of Applied Science in Cleveland. Wickenden created an extraordinarily detailed plan for his committee, to assess engineering education. A preliminary plan shows subdivisions of authority, lines of communication, data flows, responsibility for outcomes, designs for final presentations. He had grand plans for the committee, a comprehensive survey of the whole situation, he wrote. Students and graduates, faculties and facilities, curricula and methods, professional engineers and industry, and the economic and social significance of engineering. Well, in the end, Wickenden's committee produced a very sympathetic and simple report. Well before they completed their work, the members concluded that there were no glaring defects in the contemporaneous polities and methods of engineering education. At the same time, the committee established the idea that education could be studied with the tools of engineering, and that education needed to be treated as a process that needed continuous improvement. There were many readjustments which were needed, the committee concluded. The situation called not for revolution, but evolution. It was work a pedagogical Walter Schuart could understand. Plan. Do. Check. Analyze. Repeat. I don't know if Elena and her team did a formal assessment of their presentations to our committee. If they did, the feedback for their Schuart cycle would have been swift, brutal, obvious. we did not buy their software. If they looked more deeply at our response, they might have discovered that the members of the committee responded in different ways to their presentation. The variations in these responses were determined not only by the different goals of each school, but also by the social structure in which each school operates. The engineering school, by far the most sympathetic to Elena and her crowd, is part of a complicated but fairly unified social structure. This structure contains accrediting bodies, engineering societies, professional exam boards. These groups are used to debating the nature of education and finding common ground among themselves. By contrast, my current school, which is the College of Policy and Current Events, abides in an anarchistic landscape and has little experience in working with other institutions to define the goals of higher ed. The combative nature of the group is suggested by the title of its courses: Civil Wars, Terrorism, Military Strategy. It even teaches classes in pirate theory, although they tend to call such courses transnational security threats, and limits the examples of the modern pirates to Sudan and the Straits of Malacca. According to the best scholars of the field, pirates are most effective when they are able to control their operational goals and when they are able to build strong bond of empathy among their band. There actually are scholars of piracy, and they have actually written such books. Well, to do this, the pirates, that is, they usually need the tacit approval of a nation-state, freedom from absent owners, which is usually achieved by simply stealing a boat. Although one could, of course, buy one with stolen funds. And finally, assembling a team that accepts the twin goals of, 1, expanding plunder, and 2, avoiding capture. It is not a situation that really parallels the AT&T of the 1930s with its goal of universal service, but it works tolerably well. In this circumstance, we have the simple debate over Schuhart's cycle. Will the new strategy increase the chances of gaining treasure? Will it make them more vulnerable to naval attack? They usually demand a full discussion of all hopes and doubts in such debates. No pirate wants to worry about the concerns of others in the midst of a raid. Perhaps because of this, they are really never available when you want them to disrupt a sales presentation that has gone very badly out of alignment. Well, you've been listening to In Our Time. This podcast was based on an essay which appeared in the November 2009 issue of Computer, which is a publication of the Computer Society. More about both Computer and the Computer Society can be found at www.computer.org. And if you wish to find the information about Computer, click on the Publications tab and go to Technical Magazines. There are other Computer Society podcasts that can be found at this page. Scroll to the bottom and you will find them. If you have any comments, we'd love to hear them, which you can send to podcasts@computer.org. The music for this podcast came from the Podshow PodSafe Music Network, which you can find at music.podshow.com. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you next time.